Hello everyone, welcome to Manual Therapy Blog. I'm your host, Matt Thomason. For this episode, we get to continue our interview series in which we talk to different physical therapists or different manual therapists from around the world and get to learn a lot about their past, you know, their history, where they came from, what influenced them throughout their career and led them to the path that they're that they've gone down and where they eventually led up to today. In previous interviews, we've gotten to speak with some well-skilled, fairly well-known instructors within the U.S. and even abroad, and really get to hear different habits or unique things about them that has kind of influenced them along the years to where they, you know, get to become either highly skilled or very well versed in manual therapy and get to pass that on to other clinicians like myself and like a lot of you listeners out there. One thing I do think is interesting in getting to speak with a lot of the manual therapists that we get to listen to with this blog are the differences and, more often than not, some similarities between each and every person, and how they have gone about, you know, self-discipline and improving their skills or improving their knowledge base, or how much they care for their patients and their community, and not just that, but other clinicians, and passing on that knowledge. It's pretty impressive. So I hope that most of you out there are enjoying the different therapists, manual therapists, that you get to listen to on this podcast. And as always, if there's anything that you want to hear that you haven't gotten to hear, or questions that, gosh, you know, I really wish he'd asked this question, or I really wish they would have talked about that, write a comment, send me an email, let me know. I can try and get back in touch with everyone and ask whatever you guys want to hear. I want to make sure that people are enjoying this as much as possible, so if you're missing something, then let us know. On this interview, we get to speak with Gail Wetzler. Gail Wetzler is a physical therapist here in the U.S., and to better give you an idea of a well-written biography from her, I think I'm just going to read off of a biography that you can find online. And it goes, quote, "Gail Wetzler currently owns an integrative physical therapy practice in Denver, Colorado, where they treat orthopedic, fascial, muscular, soft tissue, neurologic, pain, respiratory, digestive, and multiple TBI and women's and men's health issues. After receiving her initial degree in physical therapy, she pursued her first experience in acute orthopedic care at Hoag Hospital in Newport Beach, California. Within 1 year, she became the outpatient clinical supervisor and thus began her journey and desire for continuing education in the science and art of human movement and function. She studied with Travell and Simons, Minnell, Kaltenborn, Maitland, McKenzie, Mitchell, Jones, and Greenman in the earlier years of manual therapy education. Inspired by these methods of treatment, she became an assistant to Dr. Janet Travell, and later an instructor with the Institute of Physical Art developed by Greg Johnson and Vicky Saliba Johnson. In a few years, she developed her own private practice, at which time she received a large number of head, neck, and TMJ pain patients. This became a driver to learn more about cranial osteopathy, craniosacral therapy, and how the fields of physical therapy and dentistry could collaborate to help these patients. As she pursued continuing education classes with Dr. John Upledger, he inspired her to learn more about the different systems in the body and how they all integrated for function. During one of her earlier speaking engagements for the Upledger Institute at Beyond the Dura, she met Jean-Pierre Barral, who inspired the importance of anatomy, the ability to listen to the body, and the specificity of tissue dialogue in manual therapy techniques. She has listened and followed his mentoring into understanding the body's deeper fascial relationship of the viscera, vascular, neurological, and manual articular systems since 1989. Gail has been an instructor for the Barral Institute since 1991 and became the Braw Institute Curriculum Director in 2001. In her career, she has been invited to speak at multiple professional conferences, including national and state levels for the APTA, USC Head, Neck, and Facial Pain Clinic, University of California, Irvine, Beyond the Dura Research Conferences, HOPE Head Injury Organization, and was the keynote speaker in Italy for the Fascial Manipulation Research Conference presented by Antonio, Carla, and Luigi Stecco. She is the past director of physical therapy for the Integrative Medicine Center at UCI. She is currently part of the research team for the Upledger Foundation for their recent studies on post-concussion recovery. She currently teaches for the Women's Health section of the APTA Gynecological Visceral Manipulation. Gail is currently the U.S. facilitator and an assistant for the Diane Lee Continuing Education Series Integrated Systems Model. Gail earned her diplomat from the Braw Institute in 2005. She earned her equine diplomat in osteopathy from Lugan Institute of Equine Osteopathy in 2009. And she earned her doctorate in physical therapy from Rosalind Franklin University, Chicago in 2013. End quote. So I really enjoyed my conversation with Gail, and I hope you guys enjoy it too. There are many stories that are just fascinating to sit and listen to. Some of the things that you might find interesting are a couple of incidents when she was a child and how that influenced her to want to do something with her hands later in life. I think it's very interesting, you know, which group of people were her biggest mentors in her early career and actually her whole career, as they're still mentors. Some of the other things that I think are pretty interesting are what happens when you are brave and you are have the guts to step up in a class and step up in front of the instructor and tell them what you're feeling, tell them what you think is going on a patient where they're demonstrating, and how important it is to be organized, because a couple of those things that Gail's done in her career has really opened up doors for her in many, many ways. And one other thing I think is interesting are the two of us and our similarities in view for millennials and younger clinicians these days from our own observations and how we both have similar points of view for that. So hope you guys enjoy this little over an hour conversation that I got to have with Gail Wetzler. If you have any questions for me, as always, include them at the bottom of the comment section or send me an email. Look for us on Facebook, Twitter, as well as podcast episodes of these recordings on iTunes and Stitcher. Without further ado, Gail Wetzler. Today we are speaking with Gail Wetzler. Gail is a physical therapist who is currently living in Colorado, and a very unique interview hopefully today with Gail because of a lot of different things that she has done in the past and is currently working with, especially in regards with the Braw Institute. So Gail, thank you very much for coming.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be here with you.
Gail, usually we start off just with asking people if they could just give us a little bit of background about themselves. Where are you from, or where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Southern California and went to college there and pursued my career in physical therapy. Pretty much staying there until just 2 years ago when I moved here to Colorado. So been a lot more in California and have bases and friends and neighbors there than I actually do here in Colorado. So it's been an exciting change, an exciting start over here again. It's like starting fresh and new.
Oh, great.
But that's where I came from.
Oh, okay. So, were you into any kind of athletics or hobbies or anything like that growing up?
Well, I guess my hobby would be in regards to athletics would be, of course, team sports. But I really got into the equestrian world, and that inspired me even to go beyond just riding them and learning how to treat them. So in my career, I also have an EDO, which is an equine doctorate of osteopathy. I was a vet tech for many years. I started that after high school, going into college. I wanted, obviously, I loved animals, and that was my job to help me put myself through college. So I was a vet tech, and then I inspired to saying, gosh, I wonder what physical therapy can do for animals. And started with Peter Levine and Lynn McGonigal, one from Tennessee, one from New York, and I. And we actually were the base for starting the physical therapy kind of group, if you would, access study group in regards to getting people more interested in animals. And then it became an actually SIG section for the
Wow.
APTA. So I'm happy to be a part of at least starting that. I move beyond modalities and things like that because I am so much more interested in manual therapy from an osteopathic and PT point of view. So I really wanted to learn more in regard with animals. But I did ride. I did work with animals, and I'm really happy for that background as well.
Wow, okay. I knew that you worked with animals, but I didn't know that you had such a influence in starting up the special interest group. That's great. So what influenced you to become a physical therapist when you were first getting started in the field?
Well, I went through kind of differences in regards to what, like all of us do, what is it that I wanted to be and do. And I know that I loved working with my hands. I loved athletics. I loved science, and I really loved teaching. And I was like, what out there can kind of bring all those things together? And when I graduated from high school and thought, you know, as I looked and talked to counselors, what could I do with my hands and the science that I knew to help people? And physical therapy seemed to fit really well. I considered some other fields, but it seemed to fit really well. And I am married to my husband Craig, who his brother was dating at that time, a physical therapist at Long Beach State University that was just finishing up her degree. And she also and I talked and talked and talked, and it just really encouraged me that that was the absolute career that I wanted to take. So it was kind of fun. It was a fun journey.
Wow. So when you were saying that as when you were younger and looking into the field, that one of the things that you were very interested in is that you had a love of working with your hands. Was there anything in your childhood or growing up that kind of developed that or developed that interest or love of working with your hands?
Well, it's amazing that you asked that, I guess, because many people ask me that when I'm treating them, you know, what got you started in this? And this is an honest story. I was maybe 5 years old. And I was playing in the backyard. Again, I love sports and athletics anyway. I was playing in the backyard and we were playing duck, duck, goose with about 6 or 8 kids. And all of a sudden, one of them said, oh, I've got to stop. I have a headache. Turned to him, I said, a headache? What's that? And he goes, I don't know. I hurt in my head. And I go, okay. Well, we went in the shade and we just kind of rested a minute. And I go, so where in the head do you hurt? And he goes, right here. He pointed to his forehead. So I put a hand in front and I put a hand in back and I just left him stay there. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know. He goes, "Well, my headache's going away." And I said, "Well, I'm glad. If your headache's going away, let's play again." And that's all I was interested in at 5 years old. And so we played our game. And then about 2 years later, we were at a big church thing and at my home again. And it was all guys, and then had another little girl that was there and me. And so I wanted to play with the little girl. And she had a stomach ache. And she wanted to go rest on my parents' bed. And I went with her and I got beside her and I go, "Where does it hurt?" And she pointed to an area in her abdomen. And I put a hand in front and I put a hand in back. And within 5 minutes, she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I don't know." She goes, "My stomach ache's gone." And I said, "Good, let's go play." So totally unbeknownst to me at that time, 5 and 7 years old, was the journey apparently that God had planned for me. I looked at vet med. I looked at dentistry. I looked at dental hygiene. I looked at being a PE teacher. I looked at different things, and all of them had something that was guiding me to the way of physical therapy. When I was going through the, you know, getting the education of PT, I remembered back when I was 5 and 7, and I just saw the cycle that I was supposed to be in this career.
Wow, that's a great story.
Thanks.
So was there anything in particular, either before, during, or after your physical therapy education, that got you more interested in the manual therapy side? Or is that just something you knew from a long time ago that that's what you wanted to do?
Nah, I think as going through school, it seemed to favor Therax and exercises, and I seem to favor that. I seem to shine with that more. Modalities just, you know, I was there, I learned it, I was there, I saw what it did, but I liked working again with my hands, athletics, movement. I was very much a mover, and so wanted to follow that. But, you know, I was in a very fortunate place because Janet Travell and Dave Simons were in my area in Orange County, and Janet would travel back and forth from the East Coast to be with David Simons. And as you know, they wrote their two big books. Mm-hmm. And I had a very strong fortune to not only be a part of the facility, because I went to Long Beach State University and they asked the students that had already graduated to come over and help some of the younger students. And that's where Dave Simons worked. And so I studied with Janet Travell. And what an awesome opportunity.
Yeah.
And her background and how to look at the wholeness of the body. And so that was always something that was in the back of my mind, the wholeness of the body, not just person coming in with a shoulder. What is the relationship of the biomechanics and everything else in regards to why that shoulder pain is there? So those two really stimulated me to look more at the wholeness of the body and its relationships. So I honestly say there, I taught with her a number of years. I had the opportunity. What's got me into dentistry, that's got me into TMJ, head, neck, and facial pain. So I started with her, went into helping dentists do and kind of work with them in relationship to the head, neck, spine, and how that can contribute to TMJ disorder. Met Harold Gelb out of New York. He was the first one to really make the appliances. And then I also went on to USC, UCLA, and worked with Dr. Tanaka, Terry Tanaka, and he furthered the education for dentistry in the schools there. So my pathway seemed to be, not that I graduated from school thinking ever I was going to do that, it's just I met people that really inspired me to learn more and do more, and was called by White Memorial after a dental surgeon, oral surgeon did an activity. And then he was really pleased with what I did with that patient. They asked me to write a chapter in his book. So those were the kind of opportunities I had to move forward. And from that point, then got my interest in cranial osteopathy. And I went to Michigan State University and took all the courses there. Found out about John Upledger, found out that he was working a little differently than cranial osteopaths do. And if there's anything I were to say to younger PTs, is that I really never lost my curiosity. Wow, they're doing that. I wonder how that fits into the physical therapy world. Wow, you're doing that in dentistry and you're helping that joint and you look at the occlusion and how that affects the cranial mechanisms and the sutures. I wonder how that fits into physical therapy. So I always kept a curiosity, even to today, as to, you know, where I am and what I'm doing with the Baral Institute. But that's what started me into osteopathic medicine and learning those courses, meeting John Uplinger, working with him, and then he is the one who brought Dr. Jean-Pierre Baral over from France. And honestly, it was working with Greg. I taught with IPA for, I think, 4 years with him. And it was always a curiosity that Greg led us to, of going through the visceral organs to get to the psoas muscle, mm-hmm. you know, to help with the corrections as we looked at the spine. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden there's this French man that's talking about how important those organs are and their suspensory systems and how they affect the movement patterns in the body. And that's what Jean-Pierre was all about. As a DO, he was finding he wasn't getting all the answers just working with the spine or with the joints. Right. So I'm missing something. So he went into delving into much more of the anatomy of the organs and what they do in the body, which brings me into his world and where I am today.
Wow, that's a very quick synopsis of many years. So thank you for mentioning all of that. If I have quite a few questions based on some of that, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So going back first, you elaborated on who a few key people were in your early years. For mm-hmm. younger clinicians who may have heard of Travell and Simons and may have even seen their books, can you just elaborate on who Janet Travell was?
Yeah, she was the personal physician for John F. Kennedy and later took the work that she did as a private physician for him and others into the world of biomechanics, arthrokinematics, body mechanics, and then into the world of actually she has a background in pharmacology as well as a physician. And just bringing those together, she's the one that went into, I wonder what a trigger point is. I wonder what the biochemistry of a trigger point is. And if we did an injection, is it a dry needling injection at that point? Or was it the potential of a wet? So she was doing some kind of lidocaine or procaine into it. Would that make a change for muscles to get out of the potential of their hypertonicity or spasm? And then be able to rehabilitate them and move forward. Did it require stretch? Did it require more of an approximation? Did it require movement and rest? That was her experimentation around all the injection work that she did.
Wow, okay. And one of the other things that you kind of touched on is that you really made a point to say how you had many different opportunities early on in your career. In your personal view, do you think that those were just luck, or do you think it was being in the right place at the right time, or do you think something else was at play to kind of bring these opportunities to you?
That's a tough one. You know, some of me says I seem to be in the right place at the right time. Just the story that I shared earlier about my hands when I was 5 and 7. You know, something obviously was guiding me to be at that right place in the right time. So I attribute a lot of that to the possibility of just being guided.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, yeah.
Great. Now, you also mentioned a lot of mentors maybe that you'd had along the way a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Were there any, and it's like, trying to pick maybe your favorite child or something. It's really hard to pick one or two, but were there any mentors that had bigger influences on you throughout the years, even up until now?
I'd say Janet for sure, Janet Travell, Greg Johnson, Dr. Uplinger, and Jean-Pierre Baral. Those were my biggest mentors. I know Phil Greenman pretty well and Fred Mitchell, but I didn't get to know them as to what was their heart, what was their passion.
Yeah.
You know, you go in and you have the classes and things like that, and I saw where they were going, but those four people. I really got to know them and what their passion was and why they did what they did to make a difference in the world. And that's what spoke to me the most, is that, wow, not only are you excellent at what you do and why you're headed this way, but you really want to make a difference in someone's life. And if we do that just one person at a time, imagine what that does, how that person influences potential of their family or people they may work with. And you have, as a young therapist, and having all the experience that I have, it's just that if I can slow down and just say, I'm helping this one person right now, my whole focus is for them. And I see the fruits of that venture. I see the fruits of that passion develop and develop and develop. It's been just awesome.
Yeah, it's almost like the butterfly effect, where
Yeah.
just something so, I don't even want to say minor or small, but very important, very monumental in front of you can have an effect on everyone around them, and like you said, carry that on and on and on.
Exactly.
Do you see, in your experience, either teaching or working with others in any capacity, do you seem to notice those that, I don't know if talent is the right word, but those that seem to get better results, I'll put it that way. Is it something else about them other than just skill? Is it some kind of intention that they have with their treatments that seems to get better success? Do you notice anything like that?
I do. I do. You know, as many people as Greg and I both teach that have come through these different courses, as well as Jean-Pierre and Eplinger and Travail, all of those who have done a lot of teaching, there are those that seem to have an intuitiveness about that feels right, that works for not only you, but that works for me. It must mean something to the human being as to how that person is approaching. And so what is that? What is it that they're doing? So yes, I do feel that there's a, again, the passion comes through you as a human being. It comes through your hands. And I can say this not only from the experience of me working with humans, but I tell you, my animals and all that I've treated with them has taught me so much, because I, even in my approach to an animal who is an instinctive, they're not being controlled by some of the emotions that we as humans have to do. This is a social event. I need to be, calm and collect. But animals respond instinctively, and an animal judges me or looks at me, and what is her intention? What is this person that's coming down the hill about to work with me? What is their intention? And I have felt that and seen that and worked with that many, many times. So it's something that can come from your body. And so even the humans and how you approach somebody and that little smile versus nod or the first words, or if a person really responds more with softness versus hardness, if I approach them with softer words, that means something to them because they know I'm listening. And I don't know, Matt, if you how much you knew, but listening is so much a part of the Barral methodology. And so we listen with our hands, we listen with our hearts, we listen with our ears as to how can we help the totality of this person.
Yes, I've had VM1 and VM2 so far with the Barral Institute, and I plan on continuing my education with them and learning more of this philosophy and treatment approach. So I
Okay,
understand
great.
the concept of listening and trying to work on getting better at it. Going back to your point though of some things that you were saying of intuition and intention and how we can convey so much through our touch with a person. Is there any way, well, one, I'm sure that to some degree, some of that is a natural gift. But is there any way that we as clinicians can facilitate that and improve that over years? I don't expect it to happen overnight, but is there anything that you could speak to help develop that?
Well, I tell you what helped me along the pathway is that when you're going through school and you're learning and you're trying to, you know, take the tests and all of that, you're in a completely different place than when you finally graduate and you are with that person, and that person becomes that important connection for you, and that the listening becomes a part of that protocol. And I say that because of your question, because what I have learned to do over the years is I let their tissues speak to me. So it could be a touch that where's the attraction in the body. You've had a little bit of the listening. You know what that definition is. But when I came out of school, it was, how can I fix you? And that is a little more assertive coming out of my body. Mm-hmm. When I say to myself, what is it that I notice? How is this body going to speak to me? Can you share with me some information that we both can work together as a team? It is a very different approach that comes together because the body learns that you are there to help them. And it's not an assertive approach that it may, you know, just hold a little bit of fear. Or I got to hold back a little bit. What's going to happen here? That completely different approach opens that door. Yeah. And I really learned from all the people I've worked with that that is a wonderful way to perhaps approach some people.
And one of the questions that I have, and this is more of a question of myself, but I feel confident in a number of things with the skills that I have. And learning such a new skill such as listening or visceral manipulation in general, is along the way of your learning of this material, or even cranial osteopathy and other things. If a patient came to you and they were talking about some specific problem that they were having, say they were having hip pain or knee pain, and that's just arbitrary, but the skills that you have and the things that you know you could do to help them, but you're working on your listening skills, for example, and that leads you to some other place. What do you teach the patient to say, I know that you're coming in with hip pain, I know that you're coming in with knee pain or something else, but your body is telling me that this is more of an important issue right now. And I think if we work on this issue, the other thing, whatever that may be, will feel better for you. Do you say something like that, or is it just something that you experiment with in the clinic just to say, I need to learn this material, I need to practice this material, and even though I know I could do X, I'm going to try Y and see what happens. Is that something that
so I'm going to take you back to, I'm going to take you back to what your statement was in regards to, you know, I understand you're coming in here with hip pain and knee pain.
Yes.
But I'm finding that, I'm just going to say the cecum, just for analogy here, is the most important. Well, I don't approach it that way. I know that this is important as part of the whole treatment protocol. But what I say to him is, I'm finding that there's something up here on the right side lower quadrant of the pelvis that seems to be in relationship to your hip pain and your knee pain. And I want to show you the anatomy of how this is connected, and that you have already seen X amount of therapists and or orthopedists and or chiropractors, whatever their history is, acupuncture, and it's not made a difference. So I'm going to share with you the possibility that there could be something else in your body that is promoting the either referral or the continuation of a mechanical lesion that is causing this knee and or hip pain to exist. So I'm always bringing in anatomy. Anatomy is our science in visceral manipulation. How does a liver and the coronary ligament relate to thoracic pain or right shoulder pain? It is anatomically driven. Yeah. So we are absolutely trained to help people understand that and show that basic science.
Yeah, and I think we should also mention that you have many roles within the Brawl Institute, but please correct me if I get it wrong. One of your roles is director of curriculum or visceral manipulation curriculum. Is that right? Okay.
Yes, I am.
So you obviously know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, and one of the things in the courses that I've taken so far that is very, very refreshing is the importance of the anatomy and how it relates to many different things. Because in graduate school, mm-hmm. we're all taught descriptive anatomy. And God, I wish I could go back into school and go into anatomy labs and go back and go through some of that material, because now I have context and I understand how things are more related, which in first semester of grad school, I had no clue. You know, none of us have a clue. And that's just one of the things I love about some of the curriculum that the Baral brings forth, is that how everything is related.
And that is where Jean-Pierre started all this work. So we do not, I'm really important that we talk amongst the teachers, that we share with everyone that comes through, no matter what that background may be, that he was a spinal mechanist first. He taught spine anatomy for 13 years at University of Paris. And it was like, I'm not getting the answers. I wasn't getting the answer. He's a physical therapist first. He said, I'm not getting the answers from stretch and modalities. I'm curious. I want more. I want to know more. So he went back to his DO, got his DO, came back, and then started teaching. And then he started seeing the relationship, because what he did while he was teaching is he began working in a lung hospital. And in a lung hospital, he saw he could, after they do surgery or perhaps postmortem, he could feel the lines of tension that would travel through any adhesions that were in the pleura or the fissures of the lungs, and how that affected the spine, what he was testing. So it started there, seeing what internal structures and adhesions and lack of movement and abnormal tensions could cause on the articular musculoskeletal components. So he's always there. So we want to show, like you've had VM1, in the duodenum, so we have a TL junction problem that's not resolving with manual therapy. How is it that D1, D2, D3, D4, those sections and how they suction back to the back wall might have an effect, because the peritoneum and that car accident they had via the seatbelt is not allowing movement there. So we always try to bring his total remembrance of why he started this in the first place. And then what developed was more research and people coming in and saying, gosh, doc, I have better periods than I've ever had. I don't have the pain anymore. I don't have constipation. My moods are better. Yeah. My gosh, my lung tidal volume is better. So that's what happened along the way. But he really was hoping to help people with that muscle skeletal disorders.
Yeah. Gail, how did you meet Jean-Pierre Baral?
I was on, there's a big conference that the Eppliger Institute had, I think it was every 2 years. It was called Beyond the Dura. And in 1987, I met John Eppliger in 1985. So I was taking quite a few of those courses, pretty much to help in my career, because I was working with a lot of dentists in Southern California. And I had met a couple of cranial osteopaths and other people. So I wanted to know a little bit more about it to put it into what I was doing at the time. And so they had me on the Dura, and I was one of their speakers for one of the cases that I had. And Jean-Pierre was invited over from France for one of the cases that he had, and he you know, expressed what it was, visceral manipulation. And honestly, I spoke, and then maybe three people later he did, and he talked about going through the abdomen and getting to the psoas muscle and making change. And I go, oh my gosh, that's what we do. And all of the FM classes and stuff. And I go, wow, I'd really like to, if the potential ever comes, that I could meet him and take a class from him. So we met there, and then he wasn't coming back the next year, but the next year he was going to come back and teach. So he was doing two classes back to back, San Diego, San Francisco. I signed up for both. There were two different levels of classes, and I just, honestly, this is a fun story. I went to San Diego, took his class. We talked about gallbladders. You've had a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. Went back, worked a week, and I had a person that was about to have surgery the following week for their gallbladder. I did the techniques he taught us. She never had to have a surgery. She called me when I was in San Francisco. Where are you? I want to tell you what happened. You know, they didn't have the surgery. And I said, oh, I'm up here taking the next course with Jean-Pierre. And she goes, oh my gosh. And the next day, he got flowers from her saying, thank you for teaching all of us about this
Wow.
work.
Wow.
It was amazing. Amazing. Yeah.
And
And that's how we met. Yeah.
wow. So there's stories like that that I love to hear because you don't always get to hear these things when you take a course, or you certainly don't get to hear them when you don't go to a course or you don't know somebody personally. So how did you go from that to director of curriculum for the Braw Institute? I mean, you don't have to go into great details because I'm sure there's not a whole lot of time involved with that, but can you speak to that a little bit?
I could speak to it a little bit in regards to when I started, and I think I took a the next year he came back to New York, I took his third level, and there was a two or three times that he said, could someone come up here and see what you're finding with your hands? And I did that. I was brave, I guess. But I love learning situations, but I in front of the whole class, I went up to do something. You know, did I follow him or did I lead? And what was I finding? What was he finding? At the end of that course, he asked me to become a teacher.
Wow.
So I was just amazed, cloud nine. He had to talk to Dr. John Uplinger. And so the both of them collaborated in saying, absolutely. Even John Uplinger said, I've always wanted her on our team. And so they both called me, you know, kind of on a conference call. And they asked me to be a teacher. So I became one of the first teachers. There was just one other who kind of did his own thing and went another way. And so we had some more teacher apprentices, you know, to learn along the way. And they had for the first time when everyone got together for a teacher's meeting, apparently it was never organized. And I had things written up on the whiteboard. I had a sheet and pamphlet to follow and all this. And they go, oh my gosh. And so they got together and asked me to be the director from that. It's just, yeah, so just again, right time, right place, I guess. It just followed in.
And it pays to be organized. That's the
Yes.
thing. Okay.
So from just a few instructors, maybe through those years, we had eight that eventually developed, and now we have 38 instructors because we're international now. So it's just really nicely grown, and international teachers as well as U.S. and Canada teachers. So it's a really a nice get together when we do every July. Jean-Pierre comes here to the United States, and we have our big summer school, I guess you'd say. We're learning from him when we're doing things as teachers with each other, and so it's grown quite a bit. It's very nice.
It's nice that you mentioned that because on Facebook I'm following Ron Mariotti, naturopath and instructor for the Braw Institute, and he updated, people that follow him on Facebook page about I guess the meeting last month and some of the things that Jean-Pierre was talking about, and said that a lot of great things. So it's really nice to, even though I can't be there, it's nice to read about it. So it's really cool.
It keeps you updated. And Jean-Pierre, as you know, he has 60 colleagues that he works with back in France that do this work. So he will not have it out either in a book or up to us as learning from him every summer until it's been proven over and over and over again. I think his lowest requirement is 250 times. So he does a lot of work on the side back in France before he really brings it out in the teaching. So he's been working, he told me almost 15 years, it'll be 20 when he presents this, I think, 15 years on the relationship of the brain and the organs in the body and how it relates to musculoskeletal as well as other organs. And he's presenting that in 2020. But he puts a lot of effort and a lot of time into being sure.
Wow, I mean that's really great. And one of the things I really appreciate, and this goes with Greg Johnson as well, but I really appreciate about groups like yourself, and like the Braw Institute, is You base a lot of things off the anatomy and mechanics and relationships of things, even if there's not quote unquote evidence to say that whatever you're doing works. You know it works. You have a patient in front of you and you see you did X, this is the result Y, and so the only thing that could have changed is the intervention that you performed on him. And that's one thing I appreciate, is because as clinicians, in some ways, I believe we should help direct research and show what we're doing and what is working. Now go back and look at why it works. And I think, unfortunately, especially in recent years, it's become the reverse. And a lot of people have their opinions on such things where, well, I'm not going to do that because you can't provide me research that says that works. I don't know.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. I have another little story in regards to that. I teach for the APTA and I teach urogynecological visceral manipulation for them, to which I do a lot of external techniques, but I also teach internal techniques. And so it's unique for the APTA and those that women that, and men that do pelvic health. But it was around 2010, 11, around in there when I teach it once, twice a year, and everything kind of hit the fan in regards to, well, I'm not sure if we're going to be able to keep this going because you don't have the evidence to pursue. And so they stopped me 1 year from teaching. And at that point, I was never going to give up visceral. I was never going to give up what I believe. I see it over and over again, the changes we've made. But I did go back at that point and say, I'll go back and get my DPT. And I kind of emphasized getting it into more clinical research. And the challenges of the visceral work in the research world is that if people want instrumentation, it's how are we, what instrumentation can we use? And we're all of us as teachers are private practitioners. We're not at a university setting that may have a very large amount of money, real-time ultrasound and things like that. So we've had some holding back just because of who we are and what we're trying to accomplish. But I think that tide has changed after I did some research. I did some research. Again, the group setting is small. I did it on, I think it was 28 women on the effects of uterosacral sacral ligament on SI joint complications postpartum. So that went into research and was published over in Europe. And Brandy Kirk, one of our instructors, is doing it on the root of the mesentery and its relationship to diastasis recti. So she presented that last year at APTA. I just got published from Harvard University in the work that we're doing with visceral manipulation and cranial neuromeningeal work for concussions. And that was also 11 men through the NFL. And that is being published in a peer review journal. So we're starting, and people are asking us a little bit more, but it was that autonomic nervous system. How do we record that with the math system? And we're seeing and learning that maybe there's more objectivity that we can work with out there. So I think it's coming, and I'm pleased to say that the impetus has been me in the Barral Institute, and now others are still quite interested in researches along those lines too. In France, it doesn't matter. They have such different rules, and they don't have to do research. They don't have to. It's just like they get results. People come in and they see the changes, and that's what matters. So we here in the United States and doing this work, I think we're developing a little bit more of trying to meet the needs that others seem to want to have. And we're at baby steps right now, but I'm happy to say we're at least starting. We're at least starting.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because it's nice to hear such things. Similar topic. One of the things that I've thought about recently, you hear a lot of things about millennials in general as a generation and traits that they have. I think I squeaked out of it, or I'm right in the first year of what's considered a millennial. I don't know. But I'm more of a traditional kind of guy in a lot of ways. One of the things that I can say, I think, really positions our profession and the things that we do as manual therapists in a very good place, is the fact that I think a lot of millennials or younger generations are much more inquisitive in some ways and not necessarily as likely to do the conventional thing in terms of medicine as much as our fathers or parents or grandparents or great-grandparents were, where the physician was at the top of the food chain, so to speak, and you never question them, you just do what they say. And in terms of conventional medicine, I view this particular generation as being much more questioning of those things. And I think it really is a positive thing for what we can do as manual therapists in the health field and in, across the world.
I 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
And the people, the students that takes the classes, and you probably notice this as well, are also starting to recognize that and notice that.
Yeah.
And you get into the higher levels of the work that we teach, and there's so many changes that are happening. And sometimes I even state coming out to them is like, I really feel that those of us who do this work are getting some of the more answers than in conventional medicine. And they all were, shaking their heads, yes, and we're seeing them too. So
Yeah.
I, you know, it's coming through to all of us that that's
Yeah.
possible.
Yeah, definitely. Gail, what are you doing currently, or what have you done in the past to continue to advance your learning or your abilities? Is there anything particular or routine that you do, or at least something that you think about during your day or week or months that you're trying to get better at, and what you're doing to do that to better yourself?
Well, I never. Just a second.
Sure.
I don't know if you heard that background. But I never thought, coming from a physical therapy background, of getting into an organ background, and how much importance nutrition and what you ate went into your body and what that meant to a cellular life. Even before I did so much of this and teaching with Greg, I brought, and he knows this, we brought a lot of nutrition into it because of TMJ. And, we had to change a diet and what would you get good nutrition if you couldn't chew for a while? And so, I definitely looked at those avenues. But in an organ world, and, we share sometimes our patients with an acupuncturist who does herbal medicine, like Ron, a naturopath, functional medicine doctors. I got more involved with them in my last 10 years than I ever thought I would, because we're trying to work as a team as to what's the microbiota, what is happening by the foods that we eat, the complications that come into our practices, and the exposures that people have had. Is it through parasites and other, possible infections and inflammations and that are going through their body. So, it's an amazing journey, but I've learned so much in regards to helping people even from that frame. If it's I can help them, or if I say, please look further into the possibility of what it is you're eating that might be contributing to this. You might have to have a few more tests done. Is it blood work? Is it other analysis? But you need to look further, because every single organ that we've worked with has changed except your pancreas. And so I wonder what's going on the biochemistry level of that. The motility never seems to return right where it should. We're getting mobility in all the others. We're increasing the vascularity. The movement pattern's doing better, but that pancreas is still showing me, let's take a deeper look. So I've really appreciated that. I really appreciate others that have come in to guide what was potentially perhaps dysfunctional
Yeah.
about that pancreas. So I learn along the way. And so I look at people that come in to me as I wonder what they're going to share with me today too, that what I can learn from them as I move forward.
Right, because they're teaching you just as much as you're trying to teach them.
That's right.
Do you have any, oh, somewhere along those same lines, do you have any advice for younger clinicians on how to continue improving their touch or their palpation? It could be related to, visceral work, or it could just be related to general soft tissue or joint work. Do you have any advice for that?
I do. I learned, and we teach others in learning different components of touch is to take that anatomy book, put your hand, it doesn't matter where on the body you want to put it. If you want to learn about the anatomy of the abdomen, if you want to on the chest, if you're on an arm, and close, see the anatomy and close your eyes and do a visualization. And if you are coming down, what level would you be on? Are you on the dermis? Are you on now a fascial plane? Are you on subcutaneous tissue? Oh, that feels like epimyosin. Oh, that feels like muscle tonicity. What levels am I going through before I meet the bone? Oh my gosh, that's what periosteum feels like. So taking that anatomy and putting our hands with the finesse of I want to sense each layer is a really, really strong learning method.
Oh, great. To follow up on that in terms of anatomy, are there any particular textbooks or books that you love or recommend to further your information for anatomy?
Well, you know, I could name off all the books that are there, but what I have liked to do is I go back because our work begins with embryology. And so I go back as to how something was formed, even if it's the notochord and turns into the spinal cord. I go back into seeing what and where those come from. So Tolt and there's another one, older one that I use as well. I've gone back to what some of the first drawings were and then move up into a netter, an old passion netter or grays who doesn't give very much, and you want to go into 3D and you want to go to Sabota and you want to go into higher level, like we use a lot for the educational purses, theme, T-H-I-E-M-E.
Oh yes, I
and
love that.
And that gives a lot of information with that. You know, the digital world has come, so we're doing 3D brain, we're doing body world, we're doing atlas of human anatomy on that. So that's what the students like. And we can, you know, show the body anterior or posterior, turn it upside down, and so they can see the 3D. Mm-hmm. And that's been very, very helpful.
Okay.
But I do want to do one thing that you said in the morning, in the earlier part of our conversation, is that, gosh, I wish I had the opportunity to go back and do a dissection again.
Yeah.
That opportunity is always there through the Borel Institute. Twice a year, there's a dissection class, and they will do what you want. If it's organ-related, if you are more mechanic involved, you want to go do the knee and dissect through the knee. If you're more neurological, let's go through the brain. They are there for you, and it's an awesome 2.5 days of looking at anatomy. And that's the strongest and best advice I can honestly give. Every single student comes out of there going, wow.
Yeah.
Because they're fresh. They're fresh, you know, as far as they're not like what we had in school at all. And that's the best learning on anatomy that I can devise.
Yeah, it was nice to hear my friend and colleague who I spoke about before we started recording.
Mm-hmm.
He's taken that anatomy class 3 times, I believe.
Yep.
And each time he comes away with something different. And just to hear how cool it is to, you know, move your big toe and you can see the dura move where the suboccipitals are. And it's pretty mind-blowing, you know, really.
Yep. Yes.
So,
yeah.
Gail is, you know, you've mentioned a lot of great things so far. And some questions that I normally ask, I don't need to ask because you've already pretty much answered them, so it'd be redundant for me to ask them. However, are there any particular things or what are some things you hope younger clinicians learn from you or take away from their interactions with you? Anything in particular?
Well, the first thing that comes to me is to always stay open for learning. Always stay curious. If you find yourself burning out, then the passion and the curiosity probably has burned out. And that is it something else in this field that you might go to that might inspire you again? So if you've just been doing pediatrics and you're kind of going, oh my gosh, I really would like to move on from that. I've done that. I'd like to move on. Then look to that. I think Our career is absolutely phenomenal, and we have opened up so many doors in orthopedics, neurology, and all of the other sports, and all of that to inspire people to still take their career, yet maybe lateralize that in, into another option for them and interest for them. But the passion that you get and your heart is in it, and the learning, the curiosity of learning, that's what keeps all of us in not retiring, because I don't even know how to spell that word. So I love what I do, and I still feel good about helping people in what I know.
Great. And that's one thing that excites me too, is still learning from patients. And well, still I'm young in my career, but learning from patients. And I can honestly say, trying to learn something from each and every patient, even if I don't particularly solve their issue, so to speak. The way that I treat certain areas of the body now versus just 1 year ago is different because of continually trying to process that and reflect and learn. Gail, I asked this question just because in previous times, of course, I'm too young to have met him, but Dr. James Cyriacs, I remember from talking with some of his students that if he could be remembered for only one thing, he would choose differential diagnosis and selective tissue tension testing. If there's, and you may not have ever thought about this, but if there's anything that you would like to be remembered by in the world of manual therapy, what would it be and why?
Wow, Matt. From a professional point of view, it is that no matter what was presented to me, and I felt like, oh my gosh, I was always presented in school that I had to fix this. If I can't fix this, would I stop at that? Would I just stop? And my encouragement would be no, that you move on and say, well, what is it about this that I might be missing? Who can I talk to that might give me a hint as to what I do know can fit into this story? So always keeping that curiosity opening, and even the conversation you have with the next person is going to be enlightening and bring forth some new knowledge. The second thing that comes to mind that I shared with you earlier in our conversation is that bringing forth the opportunity to listen and listen with your hands, listen, of course, with your ears, but you're listening through all of you, I could say from the heart, but there's so much of all the integration of our intention, our intuition is in a lot of history inside of us. So the emotions that we hold, what we've learned from that, if it can't be held in the emotional center of the brain, the limbic system, it's held in the receptacles of the organs. So they can keep some things that share with you, this would be a better approach to do. Like we saw Greg do and still does for many years. How did he know that? How did he? It was an intuitive thing that he's gathered through his experience by touching people. So the taking that one step further and bringing that listening in through all of you and the intuition and intention would be something that I would cohesively say with Greg, but in particularly the listening techniques themselves, how they have helped me so much to help a problem solve a patient through something.
Well, I can tell you from personal experience in my fellowship with him, he'd be in the room with me and a patient, and we'd be looking at the patient together, and he would say, "Oh, they need this, this, and that. Work on that, and I'll be right back." And so he would start to walk out the room, and I would grab him and say, "Wait a minute, wait a minute, hang on. Tell me how you knew that, and tell me what you saw or what you felt." And that was my way of pestering him and kind of picking his brain without letting him get away.
Yes, good, good.
So, Gail, if there's any, or if you have heard or given, what is the best or worst advice that you have heard being given to other therapists? In whatever means possible, best and worst advice, and it could be one or two things. You don't have to be only one thing, but if there's anything that jumps to mind with that.
This happened even when I was in my younger days as in my career and beginning. And maybe it was just because of my belief system. When a patient came in and someone said to them, "We cannot do anything more for you. We're done. We can't do any more for you." I always sat back and go, "What? Why? There's so much that this body integrates together that can help." And as you and I and others have learned, when we talk about mirroring and what we can do with all that that has come through the ages of our career. But even in my younger time, I just had this feeling again, maybe it was that intuitive sense, what? Oh my gosh, there's so much more we can do for you. So the worst advice that I've seen people get is for somebody to say, "There's no more we can do. No one else can help you." That's definitely not in my dictionary, I guess, to say. So that would be what I would say to them.
Okay, great. And if you could challenge other therapists or other clinicians that, aren't physical therapists, but if you could challenge other clinicians, inside or outside your profession, to do something, to be something, to whatever, if you could just challenge other people, what would you choose and why?
Let me just get another perspective on this. I'm
Sure.
challenging for the purpose of their health, for the purpose of, tell me what the challenge is.
So if other clinicians specifically, if you could challenge them to do something within their profession or to themselves or to their patients, what would you challenge them to do?
I would challenge them to the integration of working with other professionals that may have another way to view things. So, say an acupuncturist gets done and they say, "Well, I've done everything I can to help you with your infertility." Then, opening up the door and looking what others have done, or talk to other fellow acupuncturists to see that, is there anything else there that could help this person? So, the integration of cross professions is something I would challenge other clinicians with.
Great. And is there any particular way, I mean, you recently moved to Colorado. Is there any particular way that you've gone about working in collaboration with other health practitioners? I mean, do you just do a cold call and say, "Hi, I'm Gail, and this is what I do. Can we chat?" How do you do you let the
Well, with me, I
patient do you
think
let the patients do that themselves and kind of by word of mouth?
Well, I went through that. I really went from 35 years working in Southern California and moving out here and going, "Gosh, will I even have a practice at all?"
Right.
And I just have been blessed. I just am amazed. And in 5 months, I was absolutely full, Monday through Friday, full. So I think the teaching that I do, there were people in California that did not want to go to other therapists. They flew out, and they still have them flying out. I see again a little bit more of the problem solving I do for other teachers and other therapists. They send people to fly in to be with me for 5 week, 5 days, like a whole week. And we accomplish quite a bit. And then I can share with the therapist that's been working with them some ideas. We did this, this, and this, if you can follow this pathway. So for me in particular, it just happened.
Okay.
And I'm blessed
Well,
in that respect.
great. In your experience, across many different treatment approaches, is there any particular body part or area or region that you see commonality across the whole spectrum of patients that come to see you that is almost vital to treat on almost everybody?
No, relationships, I do. What's happening at the base of the neck, and of course its relationship with the cranium, and then that how it involves the thoracic inlet, and then that brings anatomy of neck and thorax. What happens at the diaphragm? What happens at the pelvic diaphragm? Those are baselines for me that I frequently see, but it's the relationships of a potential injury or what might have happened on the inside. I do, that's a base and how it relates to the spine, and the mechanisms, and then how it relates to the vascular neurological system as it goes down the leg. Those are base areas, but I don't know if I've ever had one person come in always with the same thing over and over
Oh,
again.
sure. And I think that may have been a better way of explaining it. Specific relationships that you see that are a key for a majority of your patients. Okay. If there's any particular thing that you could teach to the majority of the patients that you see, is there anything that you would choose or that you've noticed over the years?
To teach the patients? Is
Yes.
that what you said? Yeah,
Yes.
teach the patients. Wow. Well, I guess what comes to me mind for the patients is also what comes to mind for therapists in regards to looking at their whole body as a whole body, not just I coming in with a shoulder injury, but going back in their history, well, how did it start in the first place, and where did that kind of come from, and how the surgery that you had in your right hip, how over the last 3 years that has been involved with the potentially of bringing in that shoulder involvement. So letting them see themselves from a whole human being and how they relate and how they move is something I frequently and consistently teach them along their path for rehabilitation.
Wonderful then. Gail, thank you so much for the time that you got to spend with me today and for all our listeners who get to learn from you. Is there any particular place that listeners can go to learn more about you or what you do or what you teach?
Well, I guess I could go to the BerralInstitute.com. So that's where I do most of my teaching. And the American Physical Therapy Association, the Women's Health section. And then any more that I would do would be in my clinic. So it would have to be through a website. And that's with the Berral Institute. They have all of that information there. So those would be the main two directions I would give.
Okay, great. Thank you
Yeah.
again for your time. Gosh, we really appreciate it and all the things that you got to share. Hope to maybe get together some other time in the future or take one of the other classes in the Braille Institute from you. That way I can learn even more.
Great. All right. Thanks, Matt. I really, really appreciate what you're doing, not only for those of us who've been in the field a while, but for those coming up, just to keep the history, keep the legend, keep this career going and moving forward, because we all are just so helpful for people in need. So thanks.
Thank you very much. Well, we'll chat with you some other time.
Okay.
Okay, take care.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Bye.